made this. Yeah.
Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce this evening's proceedings. Ushered in by a bit of cash, which is what we're going to do. And I'm sure lots of people start walking in the moment when it starts, but anyway, we're on time. And we aim to end on time because we all know that our outgoing president tends to get loquacious. A 30-minute lecture will become a 45-minute lecture, will become a 1-hour lecture. And of course, it's all riveting. But of course, it does tend to delay the reception of his night following his day. I'm Charles Melville. I have just been elected the new president of the PIPS, which is an enormous honour for me. But it's my great pleasure to steal a couple of moments of your time to pay a personal tribute to the outgoing president. As you all know, he's done a fantastic job, I think, for the last four years. And presided, which of course is the word when you're a president, presided over a tumultuous period, both in British and Iranian politics, and therefore left us in a very strong and even solid position to leave the successor to negotiate
strong
aftermath,
strong
and stable, yes, yeah. Continuity, and all these other marvellous things. So we owe Ali an enormous amount, actually, because he's really put the Institute in a fine shape, and we're in a good position to move on with confidence and humour, I hope. And while doing all this presidential work, he has actually had time to do some academic work as well, and has been enormously productive. So it's clear that energy is an important attribute for a president, and output an important attitude for an outgoing president, and I'm happy to tell you that I intend to be energetic as well. I can also say that I thoroughly subscribe to the thrust of Ali's forthcoming lecture, which is essentially why I bother to study Persian, since I've personally been doing this since 1969. I can say that I think it has been a thoroughly worthwhile adventure. And I think really without much more ado, I'll say how much we're looking forward to Ali's valedictory
indeed. Thank you very much. There's a couple of... thank you very much for that very generous introduction. And I did say to colleagues that I promised to speak for about 40 minutes in the full knowledge that that will probably mean an hour. But I will try and be sure to be on time. And the phone has gone off. And music awakens us. Before I start, I just wanted to say a few short words about a number of colleagues and friends who have passed away recently. And I just wanted to mention that Dr. Javed Golmohammadi, who recently passed away, was a great, great help to BIPS. Was a great source of support for us. On a personal note also, there's a couple of friends who I want to mention. George Colley and Ali Satoripul, who passed away recently. And I haven't had an opportunity to say anything, so I thought I'd take the opportunity now to mention really what I felt I valued about their friendship, their real sort of strength of purpose. But above all, one of the characteristics which someone will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's Edward Brown talked about the Persians, and he said of their irrepressible vitality. And I think these two individuals had a real vitality. And I count George as an honorary Persian in this respect, I have to say, who really made their mark and really had an impact. And I think we're always upbeat, never downcast in these particular difficult times that some of us may find ourselves in, depending on the way which we voted. It's always good to be upbeat. So for me, I just wanted to salute their generosity of spirit, really. I mean, I think it's a lesson, I think, to us all. And a reminder, as someone once said, that the moral to the physical is as 3-1. And on that note, I segue, hopefully, nicely into the theme of my presentation, which is really to look at some of the more ideological aspects, as those of you who know me, of the study of Iran or Persia. As a number of colleagues have already warned me during the afternoon, I have poached the title off someone. The book has already been written, and I'm not about to read you the first opening chapter of Lord Curzon's Persia and the Persian Question. However, I did think, and this really emanates from a very, very short presentation I gave at the British Academy soiree last summer, which was to look at, use Lord Curzon as a frame of reference, if you will. Curzon, of course, as most of you are aware, in his monumental two-volume study of Iran, Persian, the Persian Question, spent a long time trying to persuade his readers of the importance of Iran and why Iran was important for the Brits, or in his terms, the Englishmen, but I'll deal with that a little bit later, why it should be of such interest to those in the West. And I think it's something I want to sort of review tonight, in a sense, about, you know, what it is about Iran that remains important in both political, in a political sense, but more importantly, perhaps, in the academy, why we continue to study it. But why also, I mean, why also there are challenges that we face. I mean, there are enormous challenges in the delivery and the provision of Persian, actually. I mean, one of the great ironies that most of us here have, we all love Iran, we love the study of Iran, we love the study of Persia, but we've always struggled in a way, I suppose, to be able to disseminate that enthusiasm or to spread that enthusiasm to the wider field. We're always really not just simply a sideshow of the wider scholastic sort of tradition, but we're in a sense a sideshow of a sideshow, depending on what sort of departments we're in. And I was reminded, of course, that, you know, one of the wonders of this country in particular, and this is where I'm going to lead you to, is to use as a sort of a case study the relationship between Iran and the West, which was so central to Curzon. But if you can imagine that for about 100 years, actually, in this country, while the East India Company was operating in India, and because of India, Persian was very, very widely taught in this country up until 1857. And Persian, as a systematic study in some ways, was in many ways developed in this country. It's only in 1857, after the Indian Mutiny, and perhaps we might add Macaulay's Minute on Education in India, that we have this switch to English. And henceforth, really, the teaching of the language, and it was very popular in India, really, until the last 30 or 40 years, there was an enormous popularity here, an enormous base, an enormous foundation. But we find, for all our efforts, that often it's been quite difficult to encourage those in the university administrations to support the pursuit of Persian studies, despite all our efforts. One of the things I've tried to do in all my work, particularly in St. Andrews, in Durham initially in St. Andrews, and I know others you've tried to do, is to integrate the study of Iran into the wider social, scientific, and historical fields. Not to have us sort of sidelined in some sort of, you know, ghetto, I like to sometimes say, you know, this, to have it really, you know, there's no reason why the study of Iran as a civilization, the history of Iran as a civilization, should be any less important than any of the major European countries that we look at. And what I've tried to do, certainly, is to make sure that that study is seen not as exceptional, but really as part of the normal education of our, as what was it, Rob Bartlett said to me, the job of a historian, he said, was simply to inculcate a bit of historical consciousness into the middle class. I always thought that was a little bit unfortunate. I mean, I'd like to think we're doing something more than that, but nonetheless, this sort of idea that we're disseminating wider ideas. And I think there have been great developments in Persian studies over the last 30 to 40 years, despite all these difficulties. So, in fact, I'll go to the next slide, which seems to be on it. If we look at what these developments are, this is purely actually for your, in case you get a little bit bored, you can look at something quite pretty on that. But one of the important points, of course, is that why we study Iran in some ways has been for a number of different reasons, the motivations, and one of them has been aesthetic, of course, the idea of understanding the creation of beauty in architecture and others, but also in terms of ancient lineages, also in terms of religious roots. But there have been interesting developments, certainly in the last 30, 40 years, and one of them really has been in the development of historiography. And one of the reasons why we haven't been able to to integrate our studies as well as we possibly could has been because of the access of the availability of sources in a way that European historians have been able to do. And I think in the last 30 to 40 years, that has changed. And there's been a real revolution in the study of Iranian history, which has made it more accessible and enabled historians of Iran to do their work. Not necessarily in Iran, because, of course, that's always been a difficulty in terms of being able to do research in Iran. We've seen that recently. But the fact is now, and I think we all owe a big debt to people like Iraj Afshar and others who have compiled these documents on a massive scale and allowed historians really abroad and other places to be able to work on texts. And the text is very, very important. So what that's been able to do is allowed us to be able to study Iran on a wholly different level. One of the problems I think I've found is certainly when you're looking at the study of Iran has been that it's in some ways, as I said, been a subset of the European experience. For any of you who watch, you know, these popular films that go out and the way the Persians are represented, I know the great film by, you know, 300 and so on and so forth, the Persians always make an entrance when the Greeks are about to hit them very hard. And the Persians have always had this sort of like subsidiary role. I think what the developments of the last 30, 40 years have done is they've allowed us to study Iran on its own terms and allowed us to study Iran from the perspective of Iranians. And I think that's been a major, major shift. It hasn't necessarily seeped through as much as we would like into the academy, but it's something that I think now is beginning to sort of emanate is the wrong term, but begin to penetrate that, that we can begin to see, you know, the study of Iran from the perspective of the Iranians themselves and to see it as what we might call an autonomous history. So, to get to the main man himself, George Nathaniel Curzon. One of the problems we've had, of course, and this is a very relevant comment that he makes in his book when he's trying to persuade people. That he says that basically when Britons look at Iran, we tend to either look at it in the sort of a white heat of excitement and then actually sheer boredom and ignorance. And we tend to vacillate between these things. Now, you can disagree with the details of that statement, but there is something that I think Curzon has hit on and is probably quite accurate, and that is that basically when we look at Iran, we tend to look at Iran in a very emotional state, and we tend to look at Iran in a very from the perspective of extremes, and that what we're not doing is really looking at Iran from a sort of a rational basis of I don't want to use the term normal, but basically that sort of sense that it is a country that needs to be studied on its own terms and understood in its own terms. And I think while we may criticize Curzon from some of the approaches and some of the attitudes he had, in some ways you could say that he was very emphatic about having a what we might term today a realist approach. And of course Curzon was very fixated for him in terms of what were the reasons for studying Iran. He wasn't as interested necessarily in the what we might call the scholastic elements of study, the ideas of religious roots, the ideas of the origins of various peoples, languages, so on and so forth, the aesthetic quality. For him, it's politics. And in some ways, actually, that political reality remains to this day. So what he's looking at is the geopolitics of Iran and the importance of Iran as a player in the region, but as a player that is competed or contested over by other great powers. And that is why Britain really needs to have a much more systematic interest in the country. As I said, again, one may criticise Curzon and his ambitions, but what I'm going to do, very exciting going on out there, if I say Prince Harry, maybe you don't know. So, for all these developments, what do I think in some ways, and this is where I gave Charles a bit of a preview that he didn't sort of actually mention it, but this is going to be a bit of a, hopefully not too much of a surprise, but what I'm going to say is, what I want to really look at, really in addition to this, is not only the strengths, but also what I think, are the challenges to the subject going forward. And the challenges to the subject going forward, I think, come from, and this is where I expect to get a very, very large grin from someone in the back row. If he picks up, he's got the grin. One is obviously the whole critique that has been developed with Orientalism. Now, Orientalism clearly is very popular among the student body by and large. I used to find it extremely popular at one stage, as David will testify. And I think it's an extremely valuable critique and method. Where I think the problem arises when you're looking, and this is not obviously just applicable to Iran, it's applicable to a wide range of topics when we're looking at the other, is really when the critique, when the method becomes ideological in its own right. And it's this tendency towards an ideology that makes the study at times extremely difficult or problematic. So what, just to recap, what are one of the things that, the number of things that Said basically argues? Drawing on what we may term a Marxian reading, using his Foucault, shall we say, he talks in terms of, discursive fields. Discursive fields without which one cannot understand a culture that is beyond your own upbringing, your own field. Of course, what that implies for him is a matter for discussion, of course, for those of you who know his own background. But the fact is, what he does talk about, or what he does imply, and I don't want to blame him, by the way, for all the faults of his disciples, but the fact is that he lays out, in his critique and his demolishing of a sort of a field, in a sense, in terms of Orientalism, he opens the door, I think, for all sorts of problematic interpretations and all sorts of ideological interpretations of the texts. And I'm going to go through a number of these in a minute, just by way of example. That's not to say that what Said has done does not have value, but it does suggest, in my view, that what it's leading to in terms of it being tending towards an ideological reading, tending towards what I call cultural closure, probably I don't call it, to be honest, I'm sure someone else has mentioned it before me, but this sort of idea that what you're seeing is contained, almost exclusive zones of understanding, where you can't actually begin to understand the other with any sense of realism. This, to my mind, has created a lot of problems for the field. So whereas, you know, what we have been trying to do, what a number of us, I suppose, have been trying to do, is to make the subject inclusive, what Orientalism as an ideology as opposed to a method has tended to make it more exclusive. It's tended to make it more limited. It's tended to make it more difficult for those of us who want to study the country from beyond to be able to fully sort of understand it or to fully sort of appreciate it. It has also, in my view, encouraged this tendency towards a sort of a myth of victimhood, and it sort of disempowers those subjects of that talk. So it means, in some sense, and this actually Indian historians have done a very good job at deconstructing this, but in a sense, it means that in this case, if you're looking at the Iranians or the Persians, or whichever you want to describe them, of course, they become the subject of something more powerful themselves, and they're unable, basically, to liberate or emancipate themselves from this, because it is something that has so heavily manipulated them. And I, for my part, find this a very problematic way to go forward. And I know, of course, if you look at Said and his readings afterwards and his own responses to the impact of Orientalism, if you will, that he has also acknowledged it. I mean, he does acknowledge that some of his supporters have taken this to a degree that is very, very unhelpful. But I think this, and it's basically the wider post-colonial narratives that we face now, I think are proving extremely challenging to us being able to sort of understand the sources and understand the texts as well as they are. And certainly to understand the texts on their own merits and, importantly, in the context. Not only in the context of the way, of the area in which these discourses emerge, but also in the historical context that they emerge. I think it is quite difficult to do. And I understand the tendency these days to self-identify and so on and so forth, but I think it's something that is proving quite difficult in terms of in terms of affecting the subject. So let me give you... before I head on there, I must mention, obviously, Mill and Liberalism, which I would encourage you all to read, by the famous Cambridge historian Maurice Cowling. Cowling himself, of course, argued, back in the 1960s, as it happens, quite prescient, a very controversial text, of course, but what he argued at the time was that really that liberalism was itself a form of ideological totalitarianism. Now, this is a deeply controversial and, in some cases, an offensive argument, but it's worth, as a controversial argument, having a look at, because it does show us, in some ways, how that sort of, if I may say so, and I know it's being recorded, but hopefully it won't be repeated, sanctimonious piety that sometimes come out, it can actually be unhelpful to our rigorous study of the texts. Now, to give you an example, which is quite nice, this is Edward Brown, obviously self-identifying himself there as a Persian, and this is Hassan Ataki's idea, self-identifying as a European. Now, it's quite interesting when you look at this, because what struck me is that when Parizade came to London in 1908 in order to fight the cause of the constitutional revolution. And, you know, Edward Brown, they were in very close communication with each other. They obviously fed each other views and so on and so forth. In many ways, Brown was much more dependent, I think, on Parizade and others than initially people felt. But what's very interesting is when Parizade came to London and he wanted to sort of go out into the wider London public and sort of sell the whole purpose of the Constitutional Revolution, he obviously got into a suit. And Brown said to him, don't come in a suit, come in your traditional costume, because it will be more exotic for your audience. So I want you to think about that in a sense, actually. Because, of course, Parizade himself was somewhat sort of offended by this. He said, you know, I'm not a, you know, a musical, you know, dancing bear. Or, you know, I mean, that's not the point of me coming. But it is interesting in terms of identity. It's also interesting in some ways about Orientalism. Remember that Brown is not criticizing Orientalism at all. Curzon is heavily criticizing Orientalism. Brown is not. Brown is given very much a pass on this. And quite rightly so in some ways. He's a great champion, really, of the Iranian people. But he also did suffer from this sort of view that, you know, somehow, in order to be able to sell the case to a somewhat disinterested London audience, you know, dress in a slightly more exotic and authentic way, and people will listen to you more. Parizade, of course, is also... Those colleagues of mine are going to know that I am going to recycle some elements of what I've done. So Lloyd is sitting here and Charles, and they'll know. But it's an important point. Parizade, of course, is very famous or notorious or infamous, if you will, for the comment he made in the newspaper that he edited, Kavir, that talked about how, in order for Iranians to really modernize themselves, in a sense, they had to become European or Western, depends on the term you want to use, how you want to translate the term, both materially and spiritually. Again, it depends how you translate the terms, physically or spiritually, whatever. I tend to use the term spiritually or mentally or whatever and physically. Okay, and it's heavily, heavily grown. One of the joys of doing Persian history, by the way, is most of the critics of Parizade, when they really attacked him for this and they said, you've sold out. Of course, nobody references these things. It's only recently that Iranian historians have, by the way, bothered to reference. It's always very difficult to find out where he said these things. But they really attacked him for this one statement. God help us, I have to say, any of us historians and other scholars here, if we were condemned for a lifetime for a single sentence that you wrote in some article in some obscure national, well, not obscure, but nevertheless, one sentence. Nobody really used to take into account the fact that Parizade himself reflected on this heavily, that he argued, you know, in later life, that yes, it was perhaps a bit too robust. Yes, it was perhaps a little bit too shocking, but there was a purpose to it. I wanted to shock. The point was to get the Iranians out of their stupor, to say to them that you need to do something. Now, it depends also how you interpret that sentence, but I'll get into that a little bit later about what that entirely means. What other people also haven't really seen, and it takes a little because of the absence in this, again, we thank you, Rajaf Shah, for bringing together all these publications and the collected works of Parizade and also the collected editions of the newspaper Kavir, you know, to get it all printed, is that, of course, he said this phrase not once, not twice, but three times. He said it three times within the space of 2 years, between 1920 and 21. But most people only take the most provocative statement, not his own refinements of it, nor do they look at it in the context of what he's saying. So what basically Parizade is condemned for is being a British stooge or a European stooge. And they do that really through a deeply ideological reading of the text without looking at the context, without looking at the way the writer himself has sought to articulate it, maybe to self-critique, without acknowledging that the paper, the newspaper in which he was writing, was a political polemic. The whole intention was to shock. It wasn't meant to be some sort of academic text. But the way in which others have sort of taken it apart, they take it as an academic take. So if you look at it in terms of the context of the period, you see that basically Parizade, while you may or may not agree with what he says, at the end of the day, you have to give him a fair run to say that what he's doing is a little more measured. The other thing Brown does, of course, is Brown offers us really a narrative of what we call an Iranian awakening at the end of the 19th century, and a narrative that basically becomes the staple, the template for many other writers, including Iranian writers, to take it on afterwards. And among his more central figures that he eulogizes over is this gentleman, Jamaluddin al-Afghani, otherwise known as al-Asad Abadi, for those of us who want to take the Persian view on it. But Afghani, of course, is also a fascinating figure. He's seen in orthodox narratives, if you will, in your undergraduate texts, essays, I should say, not your texts, as the father of political Islam, as the first Islamist. Okay? And he's done this, of course, because a lot of the people who have studied him from the perspective of his Arab disciples. His Arab disciples who basically looked at those Arabic texts. Actually, you look at Afghani, I'm very fond of Afghani because he really is a rebel with a cause and he's kicked out of every capital. But what people often forget is that he was extremely popular in the West. And that a lot of his formative ideas were also made in British India. And if you look at Nikki Keddie's translation of some of his writings, what's very interesting is his debt, in a sense, to a European enlightenment. If you look at his attitudes towards religion, for instance, he's actually, in many ways, in his response to Ernest Renan, which I encourage those of you who haven't seen it, to have a look at it and to judge for yourself whether what you are seeing here is the writing of a political Islamist or someone whose actual view of religion is, well, it's okay for the ordinary people, but philosophy is much better for us bright people. I mean, his attitude is something quite different to what you would expect. But you wouldn't necessarily know that if you didn't look at the Persian sources. And you wouldn't necessarily know that if you didn't step out of your preconceptions and look at him in a whole different light. But one of the reasons he's portrayed as a political Islamist, of course, and I'm going to be corrected by Lloyd, but this is largely through discussion with Lloyd, so I'm hoping I'm right on this, although it is my reading. You're doing the vote of thanks, of course, so you better get it right. One of the reasons, of course, that Brown defined him as an Islamist, as a religious thinker, is because in the context of Europe in the 19th century, it was much more attractive than being a nationalist thinker. And so you didn't want to be identified as a nationalist. If you were identified as a religious thinker, it made you much more amenable and attractive. Therefore, Brown portrays Afghani as a religious thinker in that way. But it is, in some ways, not entirely, but in some ways, reflective of Brown's own concerns about how to present him. And I think also Brown's understanding of what constitutes a religious thinker is somewhat different to what we might understand today. And this is the other point that we have to bear in mind. Far too many people, in reading back into the sources, use contemporary definitions and place them back in the 19th or even the 18th century or whatever, or even the early 20th century, to be honest. And it's one of the issues that I want to sort of really talk about when I come to the issue of race, by the way, because race is something that is obviously a deeply controversial and deeply contested term, but one that is applied too laxly, if I may say, lax is not the right word, but too generously, perhaps, to the past, as if those in the 19th or the 18th century, whatever, used the term in the same way as we might understand it. And, of course, Afghani and his response to Renan is very, very clear about his attitude to race. But Renan, coming from a French position, a French Enlightenment tradition, does actually brag about sort of the importance of race. I mean, the irony of this is also quite interesting. He says that the problem with Islam is that it is an Arab religion, a Semitic religion, and as a Semitic religion, it doesn't really think for itself. And there were two critics of this view. One was an Ottoman thinker, the other was Afghani. But, of course, Renan's response to Afghani was that, of course, he's provided such a nuanced and interesting critique of my argument, but it just goes to show what a bright Aryan thinker he is. But that should reflect badly on Renan, not on Afghani. And I think Afghani, you know, in a sense, the way in which these things are presented, again, if you look at it in that context, in the context of the time and the way they might use the language is much, much more interesting. Now, Afghani also is traditionally seen as an anti-imperialist. But, interestingly enough, if you look at some of his writings, and I encourage you to look at it, it's in a fine book by my colleague Dr. Ridgen, on various readings, The Reign of Terror in Persia. And in this reign of terror in Persia, Afghani makes a very interesting comment. He talks about what it is that the Iranians are seeking. He says the Iranians want the rule of law. They want just government. And he says that I have managed to get this just government in agreement with the British, and the British have guaranteed it. And I have returned from Istanbul, or Constantinople, and I've gone back to Tehran, and I'm welcomed as a hero. Then all of a sudden, Nasruddin Shah arrests my colleagues, arrests my friends, dumps them into prison, so much for rights, so much for dignity, whatever. And what he then says, he says, I then appeal to the British to honour their commitment. Do they? No. But the interesting thing is that what Afghani is actually talking about is he's saying, why don't you? It is your job to honour your commitment. And this is another narrative that's also quite important, which people mistake. So, in terms of that ideological reading, if we look at the relationship with Britain, there is this sort of view that there is a strong narrative in Iran of anti-imperialism, anti-British imperialism in particular. For some reason, it's not anti-Russian imperialism. I don't understand that. I've never understood why the Russians get a clean slate of this. Historically, it doesn't make much sense. But the British get it. And the British get it because, you know, they're obviously more cunning and more intelligent, so on and so forth. But what's interesting when you look at the sources, of course, is that the relationship with the British is a good deal more nuanced than we would like. Well, actually, I do like it. But the point is that what they criticise is British policy. They say the British failed to live up to their ideals. But British politics is interesting. The way British organise politics, I know today there are many people who think British don't organise their politics very well. But it's a deep myth, and hopefully it will take some time to undermine, but we're doing a jolly good job at it at the moment. But the point is that for vast periods of our history, and vast periods of the history of Britain and Iran, certainly Britain, for all, and we talk about this sort of, I know it's we can't use the word schizophrenic, but there is a sort of a dual approach to it, a love-hate, some people say, with Britain. There is this anger at Britain's inability to live up to some of its ideals, its morals. At the same time, they admire the way in which Britain's organising themselves. And I was looking through this journal, Iran Shah, which is the successor to Kaveh, written again by nationalists, all based in Berlin, which is where to be if you're writing a polemical nationalist journal, obviously. And what's fascinating to see that Iran Shah in 19... And I will read this bit because it's worth... It took me a while. It's a free translation, I grant you, and some of you will pick up on this, but it's coming out at some stage, so you can pick holes in the free translation. But it's interesting. It's interesting. It's published or written in... Let me check. 1923. So in those days, at least, you know, the British reputation for managing politics well is still standing. It's post-war. But what's very interesting is that this journal, which is a nationalist journal, wants to go and look at what is the spirit of nations. The spirit, ruh, okay? And what they're saying is, that what is it that defines particular peoples? How do they operate? How do they... And what he says about the British, of course they use the word English, but that's the way in which the term is used, Englishy rather than British. What he says about the British is that they can be summed up, and hopefully nobody faints in the room, but they can be summed up in one word, conservatism. I know, it's a shock to most of you. But he says, but not a conservatism that is against progress, a conservatism that is in favour of progress. It's basically a Burkean reading. It's quite interesting that they have this sort of understanding. And in some cases, they're very, very... So this is what they say. The British observe, and I've used the term British for English, so I do apologise, it should be English, but the British observe their national rights and social culture and are much more insistent than others in retaining their laws and ethics, such that they are neither quick to anger nor revolutionary in temperament. And the consequence is that they do not quickly change their political and social organisation. You can see where the chap's going. This conservatism governs all political affairs, economics, society, religion, language and ethics, and even in the structure of thought and conversation and manner of attire, such that it provides strength and moderation. You can begin to see where President Rouhani has got his slogans from. The consequence of this spirit of conservatism is that the politics of Britain changes little. British cabinets last longer, and freedom of thought and opinion in this state is greater than any other country, even though at the same time one can, and this is interesting, one can witness unprecedented levels of prejudice and superstition. On the one hand, the wealthiest and most comfortable people in the world live in this land, and all the states of the world have learnt from it. On the other hand, the poorest people, even in London, live in the most appalling conditions, and yet there is no hint of revolution because they get their politics right. In sum, anyone who visits the nations of the West and then goes to Britain will see that everything in that country differs from elsewhere. The manners of administration, the style of life, the institutions of education and technology, the principles of teaching, and even, this is interesting, the form of cooking and housekeeping and the culture of entertaining. And in sum, everything has a special form and nature which is quite different to other countries in the West. But this conservative characteristic is not against the progress of Britain. Rather, a profound historical progress, thorough and beneficial, has been constructed, and it is the consequence of this conservatism that has meant that none of the habits, culture, and political forms or laws have been changed until there is a strong sense and a need to do so. The traditions that have brought forth this spirit of conservatism are drawn from a powerful perseverance, moderation, rationality, self-confidence, personal stability, and a sense of control and national pride in the people, with an extensive and social progress and success in the political governance of the nation and the international order. Now, if you read that, and it is over the top, obviously, I mean, even in 1923, it's somewhat over the top. But what it does just highlight to us is that you have a relationship, you have an attitude between Iran and the West, and Iran and Britain in particular, that is a good deal more subtle, a good deal more nuanced, a good deal more interesting than those of us who believe or argue for the sort of entirely anti-imperial structure, anti-imperial discourse would think. And it's not that, by the way, in the pages of Iran Shah, they are not critical of British policy. Of course they're critical of British policy. But what they're saying is that somehow they manage their politics well. And therefore there is something worth learning from them in this respect. And believe you me, I spent a good half hour with a colleague in Iran trying to persuade him that the Brexit vote wasn't a cunning plan. Yeah? And I gave up. Okay, and maybe he's right. I mean, who knows? But the point is, these myths in some ways, and I don't mean myths in terms of falsity, I mean narratives, they die hard. And these are built on various things, and we have to sort of see them for what they are. Now, I want to come to this statement, because this is something that, in some ways, is the... This is the denouement, so people can relax. It's 1:45. It's 1:40. It's not bad. I mean, what have I got? How long have I been speaking for? I'm not trusting Michael. He's going to say an hour or something. 35 minutes, that's okay. So I have a bit of time. I may actually finish on time in that case. I apologise for the fact that I couldn't find an alternative picture of George Curzon, but I thought this one would do. The main thing is I want to focus on this statement, which is a fascinating one in some senses because of the way it's read. Now, bear in mind, Curzon in his book makes a number of statements, some less flattering than others, obviously, about the Iranians. But one of the things he does say, by the way, it goes to the heart of how we understand these terms. He says the Iranians are the most democratic people in the world. And I can't tell you the number of times I get, you know, Iranian students and others saying, you know, we're the most democratic. Yeah, it's fantastic. Even Curzon called us the most democratic people in the world. And he's talking about the 19th century, and he's talking about Nasruddin Shah's Iran. So what does he mean by that? I have it on good authority when you look at it, obviously, in more detail, and you see what he's talking about. Curzon, you have to look, obviously, at the context. And the context of Curzon as a classical scholar slightly pretentious, if we may say so, pretentious to the extent that he was even criticised by Churchill for being pretentious, which takes something. Okay, and I have the quote if you want to hear it. It's a lovely put-down by Churchill, I have to say. But basically, when you look at it and you understand where he comes from and what his education is about, when he's talking about democracy, he's using the term democracy as a term of abuse, not a term of praise, because demos and the democracy are the vulgarity. It's actually, in some ways, he's saying it's a bit vulgar. I mean, how can the son of the court chef, the cook, become prime minister? It's really not done, you know. I mean, the proper way is an oligarchy, really. And, you know, so it's interesting. You can take it as a compliment. But, you know, when you look at particularly historians of 19th century Britain and they talk about it and you look, they say, well, the word democracy among these people would have been a dubious term. Far more interesting for them would have been the term republic. And republic is what matters. And the republic is what matters because the republic means the rule of law. Democracy means the rule of the masses. And the last thing you want are the masses telling you what to do. I can see some people in the audience are saying, damn right too. But this is it, the rule of law. Okay, so Curzon, as a child really of an education in the 19th century, as a child in some ways of the Enlightenment, would have used, you know, the language he used, the terms he used would have been defined by certain characteristics. And the problem we have, of course, is to read back into those terms that things that don't actually wouldn't have had the same meaning. Okay? He's also, because of his reputation as an imperialist, and this is something that is important to understand, he's often characterized as a racist because he's an imperialist. Sort of actually, what's interesting about his imperialism, of course, is it's probably more inclusive than people would believe. I would hazard a guess, and I would argue to you, by the way, that Edward Brown, in his depiction of the Turks, is much more racist than Curzon was. Curzon had a superiority complex of enormous proportions, but it doesn't make him a racist. Okay, and you have to bear that in mind. And there's a very famous passage that has been used, a bit like Macaulay's fictional minute on education. Some of you will have come across it on the internet where they've wholly invented it, but there's a famous passage where Curzon berates the Persians after the failure of the Anglo-Persian agreement of 1919. And he uses very, very grim language. And he says to Percy Lorraine in Tehran, I don't care if you rub their noses in it. They've got to be told and they've got to understand what's good for them. Yeah, and the passage is read and people sort of gasp. Now, you would have a right to gasp if he'd said that in Parliament. And you'd have a right to gasp if he said that in isolation. But if you look at it in the context of what he's saying, it's a good deal more interesting and more nuanced. No, nuance is the wrong term, but it's a good deal more interesting. Curzon, after the failure of the Anglo-Persian agreement to take hold, is lying in his bed, ill, with a bad back, at Kedleston, and he writes a letter to Lorraine in Tehran. And he says so in his letter. He says, you know, I'm feeling miserable, don't feel good, and I'm writing you this letter, and I'm really annoyed. He then spends 3/5, if not 2/3, of the letter attacking the British for their failure to understand his genius. Okay, and he's pretty ruthless about it. He says, so-and-so Norman has been an idiot, so-and-so has been an oaf, don't tell me about the Treasury, they're complete idiots. All the Treasury want to do is to cut spending. Well, we can understand that, you know. They don't understand that a lifetime's work in Persia, he says, is being thrown away because of short-sightedness in the cabinet. I think a lot of us can understand that, right? He then moves on to the Iranians and he says, and as for them, you know, bloody useless, and so on and so forth. And it's not, you know, it's not pleasant reading in some way. But if you put it in the context of his illness and the fact that he's a non-discriminatory about his abuse, he's abusing everyone. And the fact that when Lorraine got it, he was embarrassed and didn't know how to respond. And the fact that it was seen as such an embarrassment that the letter was never published. It was a private letter, obviously, but it was never put into any biographies. You begin to see the context of it and the context of what he's talking about. And the fact that really, at the end of the day, Curzon was patronising to everyone. Yeah? So when you see that, and you see the sort of riposte that come back from Churchill and others, you can see that, you know, basically, it's not a matter of racial prejudice. He's very scathing about Persian politicians, by the way, but then I don't think he's unusual in that respect. Yeah? So a lot of things are loaded onto Curzon, which I think are probably a little bit more problematic than they need to be. So, my denouement. It should not be difficult to interest Englishmen in the Persian people. They have the same lineage as ourselves. Bingo, he's a racist. Because what he's saying, and if you look at the context of the piece, of course, is he says, well, the reason we have to interest, the reason Englishmen, and we'll get on to the English bit in a minute, the reason Englishmen, it should be Britons, of course, should be Britons, but he talks about Englishmen, and then he talks about lineage. He doesn't, interestingly enough, use the term race. He doesn't say they are the same race as us. He basically does talk about an Aryan lineage. He does talk about a people who have emerged from Central Asia and who we share the same roots. But, of course, he's trying to sell an argument to a very, very sceptical public. I say, why should you be interested in these people far off in the middle? Because they are part of the same family. And when you look at lineage and you talk about lineage in terms of kinship, it becomes a little bit more, I wouldn't say the word appealing, but it becomes a little bit more malleable. It becomes perhaps a little bit more acceptable. Englishmen. And this interests me because looking at this notion coming from north of the border, I can tell you that many people get very, very upset when, rather than talking about Britain, we constantly talk about the English. I'm reading a very interesting essay by George Orwell on this. Orwell has a wonderful discussion in The Lion on the Unicorn, if you wish to have a look at it, on, you know, the myriad terms for the people of these islands and how complicated it is. You know, I was reading in one place that Gladstone tried at one stage to encourage all of us to talk about United Kingdomers. As you can imagine, United Kingdomers didn't gain much traction and they had to revert back to Britain. But, of course, English has always been the sort of the default term. And, of course, if you look at that term as an ethnic definition, it becomes problematic, it becomes very exclusive. It doesn't become inclusive at all. But if you look at that term as defining a system of manners, education and attitude, then it becomes more inclusive and it becomes something that a lot of people can buy into. Now, I know you may think that's problematic or some way, or you may think that's an incredible argument, but I thought I'd try and end with a bit of an incredible argument just to see if I can convince you, maybe through attrition, tiredness, boredom. You'll give in, Alan. You'll recognise the truth of this statement. What's interesting about the concept of ethnicity and the concept of ethnicity in the 18th century, certainly, is the concept of ethnicity and the definition of ethnicity in the 18th century did not denote what we would understand by the term of some sort of biological distinction. Ethnicity in the 18th century, and certainly parts of the 19th century, tended to denote an attitude of mind. And if you look in the 18th century, what's quite interesting, and the Scots were particularly good at this, particularly the Anglo-Scottish Whig writers, they bought into the idea of Englishness. Why did they buy into the idea of Englishness? Because they bought into the idea of Englishness as an approach, as a mentality, if you will, not as an ethnicity. I know a couple of my Scottish friends are getting a bit tense at the moment, but bear with me. If you look at it that way, and of course David Hume, I can stand with David Hume, I mean David Hume did it, you see, so I mean David Hume is my defence. But if you look at it in that sort of way, if you look at it, it should not be too difficult to interest Englishmen and the Persian people, they have the same lineage as ourselves. If you look at it not as a description of race and ethnicity, but a description of culture and kinship, it's a much more inclusive term. And if you look at Persian attitudes or Iranian attitudes to this, it's very interesting. Think of the word Nejad. Told by many people the word Nejad, race, is a very fixed biological term. Of course, in Iran, the term Nejad has a much more fluid use. I remember being told, absolutely, oh, you're a Nejad parast. So I just said to them, I said, what about Ahmadinejad? Yeah? I said, but surely the word is used in different ways. Could be kinship, could be descent. Lineage. So what I'm trying to say, and I know I'm forcing this argument, so please come with me, be willing in my persuasion of you. But what I'm trying to argue is that actually if you look at it, if one of the problems with the Orientalist ideological reading of this is it tends ironically to separate. It tends to create exclusivities. It tends to create biological distinctions. Or emphasize them. I'm not saying it's causing them, but it tends to reinforce them. It tends to create different spheres. And that what actually you're seeing in both cultures, in a way, is a much more inclusive reading. a reading that actually shows kinship and communality. So when in the Shahnameh they talk about the sons of Feridun and the sons of Feridun going off to Rum, to Turan and Iran. But of course, the way they define this sort of great struggle that goes on afterwards is a fratricidal struggle. But the fratricidal struggle is very, very important because it is a family struggle. I always remember Vesta saying this to me. Where is Vesta? Yeah, you said to me many, many years ago when I had hair, you said to me this thing about Iran and Turan not being distinctive races. You know, we used to talk of Iran and Turan as these sort of Turks and Iranians. And you were saying to me that it's not the right way to see it, that Iran and Turan are born of this, they're the same collective. They're like, in some ways, the Franco-German distinction in the early medieval period, both born of a single Germanic tribe in a sense, but divided. But they are part of one kinship group in a sense. And I think in some ways what you can see, or I'd like to say in a much more strenuous way, that what you can see in what Curzon is talking about, if you look at it, if you put it in the context of what he's talking about, if you put it, he's saying they are part of a kinship. They are part of also a group that can be accessed, that can be known, that can be included. And that's in a sense what I want to sort of try and argue to convince you in a sense, that this tendency to move down this post-colonial thought has resulted in division rather than in reconciliation. And what Curzon, in using Englishmen there, in a sense, is he's saying we can all self-identify as Englishmen. And we can choose to self-identify. But you choose to self-identify not because it's a biological distinction, not because it's a biological thing, but because it's an attitude of mind. See, I clearly have not convinced any of you. But I will continue this fight. By the way, what I should say, for those of you who are sort of saying, oh my God, he's lost the plot, is a lot of this is referenced in a number of articles that are coming out, or have been out, actually. So you'll see some of the evidence for this. I have an article on Iranian nationalism and the question of race, where I talk about this whole notion of racial classifications. And one thing I can tell you, of course, is that the notion of race and the biological distinctions of race were much, much more fluid in terms of definitional terms in the 19th century. But, and here's the difference, is that the Franco-German narratives, and certainly the German narratives, and the British or Anglo-American, if you will, British-American narratives were somewhat different. That's not to say there are varieties within those, but the fact is the narratives are somewhat different. So what I want to end on, lots of relief, is this notion that there is an inclusivity, that there is a value to the study of Persia. Persia and the Persian question simply is, in many ways, a mirror of ourselves. And that there's nothing exceptional about the British experience. It is contingent, but it's not exceptional in that sense. And that when we look at Iran, we look at different aspects of our own experience. I know that's a somewhat grandiose argument, but as I said, bear with me on it, in a sense. What I'm trying to argue is that the way in which we really make sure that Persian studies is a much more fundamental part of the syllabus in the Western world is to see it as part of the narrative of the Western world, and that the case studies that they represent are the case studies that we would benefit from. That it's not simply looking at Iran as an example of decadence, if you will, which it was used to great effect by Gibbon and others, but that these things can also afflict us. And that civilization and progress, if I may say so, is not a linear one-way street. We can make our progress, but in honor of Herbert Butterfield, I should say, the Whig narrative is not as clear as we might like it to be. On that rather anticlimactic note, I think I will end. And I'm very relieved that I get no questions. And I think it's 7, isn't it? So that's not bad. I've done all right. I think on the sheer basis that I finished on time, I should get a B+. So thank you very much for your patience. There's a lot there. I know there's a lot that you can find in, as I said, if you're interested in some things I've published where it's fully referenced, I can assure you. And thank you again for your patience and for listening so keenly. Thank you. And that, by the way, is Britannia and Persia together in harmony in 1744. It's a long time ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Lloyd Ridgeon. I'm the incoming Vice President of BIPS, and I've been asked to give a vote of thanks. Earlier on this afternoon, I asked you to be kind and merciful, so I'm going to do my best.
That was me.
I talked about a revolution in the study of Iran, and you mentioned Iraj Afshar, who of course has done sterling work in producing the texts. But I think Ali's been very, very modest. In the respect that we need historians like Ali who can perhaps show us the meaning and the significance of such texts. And I think one of the interesting points about the presentation today is that there are so many questions that we can ask about this critique of Orientalism and what it means to be an English person. And I think what you've really done so well is that you've really shown that the gate to Ishtahar is certainly open. So you can certainly thank Ayatollah Ansari, Professor Ansari, for doing that. And I think we can point to, again, he's being so modest, we can point to a number of his works, such as Modern Iran, 1921, 2003, Confronting Iran, 2006, Modern Iran, the Pahlavis and After, 2007,
that's just the second edition,
The Politics of Nationalism in Modern Iran, 2012, and most importantly, a very thin, small volume, Iran, a very short introduction, 2014. Now, I'm not being facetious. I have it on good authority. This is essential reading for the Foreign Office. Unfortunately, I don't think Boris has got there yet.
No. He did, he picked up a copy.
Did he?
Yeah.
Did he pay for it?
No.
A last note. In some ways, as a personal note, I'd like to thank Ali for being such a fantastic president of BIPS over the past 4 years. I was responsible as the chair of the research committee, and I'm really thankful for Ali because he put in place such procedures and transparency that it made my job so much easier. We know what our jobs are now. I think BIPS is in a much, much stronger position than it had been for many, many years. BITS is now in the 21st century. Unfortunately, we don't accept questions in these events, but we do have a reception, and I'm sure if you do have questions or suggestions or comments, you can approach Ali.